everyone, and thank you for coming to this talk about early Buddhism. I'd like to structure tonight's talk into two parts. The first part will be quite short, the second part longer. In the first part, I'd like to talk about early Buddhism, but not so much the content of early Buddhism, but the methodology that makes sense to me in to discover what early Buddhism might be. And then in the second part, I'd like to invite you to ask questions in relation to what the content of early Buddhism might be. When we talk about early Buddhism, we're talking about the Buddhism of the Buddha's time and close after the Buddha's time. So you would have learned by coming to the different sessions in this Path to Enlightenment course that Buddhism has many flavors and has changed in many different ways over time and place. So early Buddhism is a term used by scholars to describe the Buddhism that probably existed in the time of the Buddha. So good scholars are always very conservative and precise in the way they use their words. They say the Buddhism that probably existed in the time of the Buddha because we don't know exactly what the Buddha did. All we can do is infer based upon evidence. So that's always the situation about the past. If you weren't there, you just don't know what happened. But what you can do is look at the clues, a little bit like a private investigator investigating a murder. And you can try and work it out to the best of your ability based upon probabilities. But unless you get a confession at the end, or you find somebody who actually saw the murder happening, then all you've got is probabilities. So, early Buddhism, by and large, is a scholarly pursuit, therefore. Academics looking at texts in different ancient Indian languages and in Chinese and in Tibetan, and trying to work out from all of these ancient texts using all the usual scholarly methods what is most likely to have been the sorts of things that the Buddha actually said 2,500 years ago. So a lot of work has been done in this area ever since really the 19th century, starting with the European Indologists. So you've always got to keep in mind that as human beings, we're in this very, very tricky situation where we're intelligent to know that there is something called the past. But most of us don't actually have the capacity to really know what happened inside the past. Unless you have psychic powers to look directly at what happened in the past, if you're honest to yourself, then actually you don't really know. And this is a problem that we have in all human civilizations, that basically once you're trying to investigate more than 100 years into the past, you're into a mass of darkness. Because most people don't live past 100 years, so you've got no eyewitnesses left to tell you what happened before that. It's very useful to just remember that as a human being before we talk about Buddhism. That this problem about what happened in the past is not special to religion. It's just a problem that we have as human beings in general. And it's important to have that general approach because we live our lives with a bit of common sense, that we do a whole lot of things without 100% certainty about anything. So even though you and I don't know for sure whether or not there really was a man called Napoleon who lived several hundred years ago in France. I've never been to France. I've never looked at the primary documents. But there are experts out there who have apparently done the research, and they tell me that there was a man who was very powerful and short called Napoleon. Yeah, so that's history. And we get on with our lives. There's a whole lot of stuff we don't know, but we assume that it's true based upon the evidence that we have. And we get on with our lives, making the best decisions that we can with our lives, based upon probabilities. So that's important to remember, because there'll be a lot of people who will say to you that early Buddhism is a waste of time because you can't rely on text whatsoever. And therefore, you know, throw out all the old stuff and just rely upon what people living right here and now tell you about their enlightenment experience and the way they did it. So with everything else in life, we work with probabilities and we're happy with that. So long as we can use the probabilities about what happened in the past to help us live meaningful lives right here and now and make good, wise, meaningful decisions right here and now. Okay, so up to date, we have a whole lot of academic, abstract ideas about what early Buddhism is. And if you want to know whether or not something is true, you can take another approach to verify. There are people who make TV documentaries about pyramids or about crossing the oceans as a Viking. And what they do is they do their textual studies and they try to work out the way that the Egyptians probably built the pyramids. And then they'll do something wacky, a bit Mythbuster style. They'll say, right, okay, we hypothesize that this is the way they built the pyramids. Now we're going to do it. We're going to hire a whole lot of people and we're going to get them to, say, pull big blocks of stone across the desert on logs, because that's a hypothesis about how they got that stone across that huge distance in the desert. Or, okay, we've looked at the text and we figured this is the way that the Vikings built their ships. And so now we're going to build that ship according to that method, and we've got some ideas about the way that they use those ships. So we're going to jump into that ship that we built and then sail it across the ocean. So by running those experiments, at the very least, you can see whether or not the method that you hypothesize actually works. And if there's no way that it works, it tells you it's very likely that your interpretation about what happened in the past is incorrect. So to date, there's a lot of talk about how what's described in the early Buddhist texts, in particular something called the Pali Canon, is very, very different to what is happening inside Buddhism today in all of the traditions. But there's not necessarily a lot of embodied experimentation to see whether or not practicing in line with those old ideas actually work. So many years ago, I decided to give experimentation with my own body and mind a go. So one thing that characterizes the life of monks and nuns in the early Buddhist texts is that they live with only three robes. So that doesn't mean three sets of robes, it actually means three pieces of cloth. And an alms bowl, and an optional blanket, and a few other sundries that they carry around inside their bowl. And they walk around barefooted everywhere. They live a nomadic life, wandering from place to place, teaching wherever they go if they're qualified, and staying for 3 or 4 months in one place per year during the monsoon season of India. They eat only one meal per day. They don't receive, use, or store up any money. And they don't store up any food either. So I decided to give living that life a go. And I decided to try that in Australia. So the hypothesis that I was writing was that the Buddha inside the suttas, inside the Pali Canon, is described as a person who could know anything that he wanted if he directed his mind towards it. So he couldn't know the future, because the future is just inherently unknowable, but he could know as far as he wanted into the past, and it seems as far as he wanted inside the universe, so time and space. So my hypothesis was that the Buddha taught certain principles which are timeless and universal, including the principles of the monk's life, and that the monk's life is actually not meant to change. It's not meant to bend to cultural influences around it, to the new lands that it travels to. It's actually designed to be resilient so that it's able to stay the same no matter where it goes, pretty much the same no matter where it goes. So I thought, okay, if that's the case, then it should work in Australia, a place where there's not a huge amount of Buddhism. So I walked from the Gold Coast to Townsville, a distance about 1,500 kilometers. And I did it the old-fashioned way, with just three robes, a bowl, a blanket, barefoot. And I also did it without any organized support. So nobody knew that I was back in Australia, including my parents. So I made that entire distance. It took me something like 9 months. So 20 kilometers a day, 1,500 kilometers, so that's probably 75 days of walking. And I received food in my bowl. I didn't take any lifts. And I didn't have any organized support, which means that all that food came from strangers who would then become friends and who would then support me. So once I got to Townsville, I was very, very sure that, well, I felt very, very confident that my hypothesis, my line of reasoning was correct. That the old-fashioned monk's life is timeless and universal. And that gave me great faith that the Buddha really was a really, really smart guy. And gave me faith to be very, very careful about treating the Buddha like he's stupid. Because that's what we tend to do as modern people. We look at ancient texts and say these people are stupid. They're not as smart as we are. Because they don't have Facebook. And they don't even write. And it's because they're stupid and they're backwards. They choose to do things in backwards ways. So I started to change my line of reasoning and say, okay, maybe there's a reason why the Buddha decided to do things in a very, very simple way. Because if he can remember back in time, and he describes a universe as being a universe of cycles, he sees the rise and fall, not just of civilizations, but of world systems. So my hypothesis is that it would not be completely impossible for the internet to have risen before, for nuclear bombs to have arisen before in past civilizations, in past universes. And the Buddha could see these things. And given that he could see these things, there may be a reason for why he set certain rules, in particular for the monks and nuns, for the way they should be living their lives. And my understanding at the moment is that he did that because he wanted his monks and nuns to do two things. One is to be an anchor to the rest of society, to be a mirror to everybody else. That if the monks and nuns stay the same, then everybody else can see how much more complex they are becoming, and unnecessarily so. Greedy, hateful, deluded they're coming, and unnecessarily so. And then also, I think he wanted the monks and nuns to stay very, very simple. Because by being simple in terms of material things, a person has the opportunity to develop a very, very different kind of technology. The technology of the body and the mind. So the early Buddhist texts just speak as if it were common sense that if you practice the Noble Eightfold Way at the level of a monk or a nun, then eventually you should be flying through the sky and walking through walls and walking on water and diving in and out of the earth and reading other people's minds and talking to the gods. That's pretty fancy technology. But obviously pretty tough to develop as well. So it's something that you can't mass produce. You can't have the blueprint and tell a factory to create it and then spread it across society. You actually need people to invest their own time and energy into evolving their own body and mind to do that. And it seems very, very difficult to do that if a person is living a very worldly life where their time and energy is going to the production of material things. So that's what I do. I know the text quite well. I'm not a scholar, but I know them pretty well. And I constantly hypothesize about what the texts actually mean. And one thing that's special about my method of textual interpretation is that I'm just quite simple about it. I'm willing to call a spade. So I don't overinterpret anything. My first rule is to just read everything with just the surface meaning and treat the Buddha like he actually knows how to use words properly and not say things like, well, when the Buddha used the word dog, actually he meant elephant. It's not very respectful. Particularly because the Buddha described the Dhamma as well expounded with the right meaning and right phrasing, and he describes himself as being a master of language. So a master of language uses words with meaning and uses words in a way that ordinary people can get the meaning on a straightforward basis. So that makes me, I guess, a sort of a fundamentalist. I don't first go to a metaphorical interpretation because I don't want to give myself wiggle room. What I want to do is bind myself to the Buddha. I want to work out what he wanted and then do that rather than interpret the text so that the Buddha becomes a reflection of me. And if things don't work out, like, you know, if I'm following an instruction of the Buddha and find that it's making me really, really ill, then I'll reinterpret and say, okay, maybe he didn't mean that because I'm getting really ill and I don't think he wanted that because I can't practice while I'm really ill. Or my greed, hatred, and delusion are going up. Or I'm getting you know, into arguments and fights and stuff like that. These are all concrete indications that practice is going in the wrong direction. So that's it, that's early Buddhism. You've got a whole lot of textual evidence, some archaeological evidence as well, about what might have happened 2,500 years ago. And you've got monks who do their best to experiment with those texts with their own life. To work out and get some further evidence about what would have been done 2,500 years ago. The third stage, which I haven't reached yet, is you interpret the text and you practice the text so well that you actually develop the capacity to remember past lives and to see for yourself what happened 2,500 years ago, and then the argument's over. Yeah, but nobody would believe you if you did that anyway. The best you could do is get into a community of other monks and nuns who can do the same, and then you can have a decent conversation about it. Okay, so I'll open the floor. Are there any questions about how early Buddhism is different to the other traditions? In my opinion.
Might be a silly question. I'm just thinking if, because at the Buddha's time was in India fully hot all year round, If he practiced in Australia, would he wear shoes in winter?
He's like, if Santa Claus was giving presents in Australia, would he wear shorts and clogs?
I just feel, sure, winter you'll be cold, your feet will be cold.
Mm. No, so is India warm all year round?
I guess so.
Really?
I've never been there.
Yeah, but it's not. Yeah, not where the Buddha was wandering. So the Buddha was born in Sakya country at the foothills of the Himalaya.
Oh.
Yeah, it's cold in winter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's actually one sutta where it's where the Buddha is described as sleeping outdoors in the winter, in the period where there's frost.
Oh.
And he's certainly got his three robes to sleep in. And a Brahmin comes along and says, aren't you cold? And the Buddha says, nah. I mean, I can't do that, but we do need to question assumptions that we are often told to believe in by the traditions.
Just repeating your question back at you, how is early Buddhism different to the other traditions?
Oh, you need to be more specific in your question.
Which other traditions?
Which other traditions are you talking about?
Maybe just Theravada.
Just Theravada? Okay. Can you think of a specific part of Theravada that you'd like me to talk about?
Supposed to talk about Thai forest or something like that?
Yeah, but it's too big a topic, so you still need to narrow down the question.
General answer?
Are you talking specifically of the Ajahn Chah tradition?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. One of the most important differences between Buddhism and all the traditions is its relationship to lineage. So it's very clear inside the Pali Suttas that the Buddha didn't want his dispensation to turn into a dispensation of the blind following the blind. Because that's what he's constantly criticizing the Brahmins about. So, inside the fourth chapter of the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says that monks aren't allowed to ordain anybody else to be an upajaya, a preceptor, unless they're fully enlightened. They're also not allowed to ordain any novices unless they're fully enlightened. Sorry, they're not allowed to receive the services of any novices unless they're fully enlightened. So this is a very, very problematic aspect of every single tradition. Now, what every tradition does is that they create a mythological lineage of fully enlightened beings that run all the way back to the Buddha. So there will even be chants that are just recitations of names, which are meant to authorize the tradition as being created by this lineage of fully enlightened beings going all the way to the present day. But those chants and those lineage charts never actually stand up to scrutiny. There are always gaps and nobody's able to explain them. So what we're talking about here is epistemology. How do we verify our knowledge? How do we know that our knowledge is true? And we've got a very, very big problem in terms of being able to make the claim that we know what Buddhism is absolutely just through the lineage and through the lineage of your particular tradition or the branch inside your sect inside the tradition. Okay, so on the other side of that is verification of the Dhamma through direct contact with the Buddha nature or the natural mind. So different traditions use different words. So what we're trying to do here is say, okay, you don't need lineage to say that, right, you've got it right, but the Buddha nature is just sort of always there. And all you need to do is do some sort of meditation and connect with it. And then you have, in this very moment, verification of the Buddha's teachings. And what that does, basically, is if you've got it, whatever the tradition wants to call it, then whatever comes out of your mouth is enlightened words. And I think that's quite problematic as well, because it's... it lacks checks and balances. It's very easy for a person to delude themselves into thinking that I've got it, and then say anything like, well, you don't need to keep your precepts. Well, it's okay to kill or steal so long as you go through a ceremony, and then the ceremony will protect you from the bad karma that comes from killing and stealing. And believe me, because I'm an enlightened Zen master. So that's what happened in World War II. So, before the Buddha died, he made it pretty clear that his dispensation isn't meant to be a guru teaching in either of these senses. A guru teaching in the sense of, okay, you're part of the lineage, and therefore everything that you do is right. Or you've got the enlightened experience of some sort, and therefore everything that you do is right. So in relation to lineage, the Buddha, when asked who will be the teacher after he dies, he says, well, no, I don't have a successor. Or if there is a successor, if there is a teacher to replace me, it's the Dhamma, it's the suttas. It's the literature that he created and asked his monks to memorize, his monks and nuns to memorize and pass down generation after generation after generation. And in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he makes a specific point that anything that monks and nuns say has to be checked against the suttas. And if it's not in line with the suttas, then you can come to the conclusion that it's not correct. So that's the four great standards in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it seems what the Buddha was setting up instead was this two-pronged method of verification. One was faithful preservation of his words, and the second was then practice. And by practicing, you should get the fruits which are described in concrete detail inside the texts. And then he says there's a hierarchy inside the Sangha, and it's not based upon how many years that you have. It's based upon whether or not you're getting the fruits described inside the texts. And then, even though those people who get those fruits should be considered on par with the Buddha as being like the ultimate teacher, they should be well respected, universally respected inside the Sangha. So, in order to set up that sort of system, what you need is a whole lot of people, both within the lay community and the monastic community, who are willing to ask difficult questions. You have to basically ask questions in order to judge the attainment of other people. And this system has been contravened, in my opinion, by the culture that we have inside Buddhism of you're not allowed to judge anyone, and in particular, you're not allowed to judge any monks, because that makes you an arrogant and conceited person. And in my view, it doesn't seem to be the Buddhist perspective on things. It doesn't make you an arrogant and conceited person. It means that you're a person who's willing to think straight about difficult issues.
Makeup stop.
My blanket moves around a lot, so now every 5 minutes. Yeah.
I'm just curious. So then, if early Buddhism is trying to be as accurate to the text as possible, then how would it react to the, you know, when the female nuns are created, like the Buddha created a set of rules for the female nuns that is sort of making them like lower than men. Then how would then early Buddhism think about that?
Yeah, well, because early Buddhism is grounded inside hard-nosed textual studies, what we can say is that there's a lot of interpolations into the early Buddhist texts, and it seems quite a lot of interpolations in relation to women. So whenever you're looking into interpolation of text, what you always find is that interpolations will always arise the most in areas of political controversy, because people want to rewrite history in line with their own views. So in the early Buddhist texts, then you can be sure that there's going to be interpolation in relation to women in the Sangha and women in general, and in relation to Vinaya, the monk's rules. So things like the Garuda Dhammas, a lot of them are anachronistic. So they don't make sense when you do textual studies, when you try and see when rules arose in time. And there's just so much evidence that rules have been read back to the beginning of the female Sangha. And that's an indication that it was probably put in there by monks later in time to keep the ladies under control. Yeah. So that's something I always keep in mind when I'm reading, particularly the Anguttara Nikaya in relation to women. Yeah, there's quite a lot of really nasty sexist stuff in there. But as Bhikkhu Bodhi points out in the introduction to his translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya is probably the easiest place to fake suttas, because they're so short and they're so formulaic. So if you just kind of slid in a really sexist sutta, nobody would notice. Whereas if you try to fake a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it would be a very, very different thing, because there's only 152 and a lot of people would have actually known them, like the back of their own hand.
What are some of the tests of enlightenment that the Buddha gave?
Yeah, so keep it simple at first. An enlightened person has no greed, hatred, and delusion. And inside the early Buddhist texts, because the Buddha actually invites people to judge his monks and judge him, actually. So the classic example is the Vimamsaka Sutta in the Vajranikaya, where the Buddha gives criterias by which anybody should be judging him. We need to assume that that you can call a spade in relation to people's behaviour. That if a person looks like they're angry, they're actually angry. If they look like they're lustful, they're actually lustful. If they look like they're scared and deluded, they're actually scared and deluded. In other words, that you're allowed to take in the evidence and make a judgment call based upon it, and that you shouldn't say, oh, he looks really, really angry, but he's enlightened and he's just acting, right? Because that's a pretty good way to get away with anything. So I jumped up and down at you and screamed at you for asking a hard question, and then you know, said, "Oh, but don't worry about it," and I was just playing. And you think to yourself, "Oh, you look pretty angry at the time."
But there might be times you're tough with the children at the school because you feel they need toughness.
Yeah, but you see, tough is not the same as angry. Yeah, tough and stern is not the same as angry. And a fully grown adult should sort of look at those situations. And you see a teacher acting tough, and the fully grown adults, because they're fully grown, they can see that the teacher's just, you know, putting on a stern face, but they're actually not angry. But the children are forward. Right? So, if you're an emotionally mature and intelligent individual, you can feel what other people are feeling. You can tell whether or not they're angry, whether or not they're lustful, whether or not they're fearful. You look at their body language, look at their eyes, look at the way that they're talking to you. On a deeper level, you sort of just feel their mind, feel their energy. And if you feel out of anybody that there is evidence of anger, then they're not enlightened. And then all the basics, that they kill, they steal, they commit sexual misconduct, they lie, they take drinking drugs, they speak harshly, they speak divisively, they speak idle chatter, they cultivate a mind of covetousness for material things, they cultivate a mind of nastiness and aggression, and they don't believe in karma and rebirth, then they're not fully enlightened either. Concrete. Really, really concrete. The beauty of early Buddhism is fundamentalist. It gives you something you can actually hold on to and use, rather than being so fuzzy about boundaries that you don't know where you stand. Now, fundamentalism is actually never a problem in any religion. The problem is dogmatism, which is not the same as fundamentalism. So if you want to run a good scientific experiment, then you have to be a fundamentalist about the way that you run the experiment. You can't give up your principles about the way that you run an experiment, or else you don't know where you stand. You don't know what the evidence means. But if you run a hypothesis and then you get results that don't match your hypothesis, and then you dogmatically hold on to your hypothesis, that's a problem. Yeah, so a skeptical fundamentalist is a scientist, a true scientist, a person who holds on to the fundamentals of their hypothesis and their experimental method, and then finds their results don't match the hypothesis, and then they change. They change the hypothesis. So in that sense, early Buddhism is a science, and it's fundamentalist, and it's skeptical at the same time.
Dante, would you say that in early Buddhism, a lot of it really turns on, obviously, the Buddhist texts that has been passed down from generations to generations?
Yeah.
But because it's in Pali, it also depends on the interpretations of the day, and therefore that gives then wiggle room, so to speak, in terms of how people will interpret the Buddha's teachings.
Yeah. So I think the Buddha had this in mind when he developed the text, so that's why they're so repetitive. So not just in terms of the one formula appearing in many, many different texts across the Nikayas, but the one sentence will be highly tautological. So it looks like he's just being a really boring speaker. But I think what he's trying to do is to ensure, do everything that he can, that people can't misunderstand him through the desire to interpret in line with one's own greed, hatred, and delusion. That he's trying to tie people down in terms of interpretation. So I don't think it's that easy to interpret the standard formulas, like the core of the Dhamma inside the suttas, any way that you want to. Like, you just can't say, for example, interpret out rebirth when you really know the text properly. There's just a mountain of evidence that the Buddha didn't just believe in rebirth, but he's talking about rebirth as a scientist. That he's gathered the evidence and he's just telling us to believe because we can't see, but he's got the evidence. The other thing about the early Buddhist texts is the usage of concrete similes. It's very, very important to me to respect the Buddha's facility with similes. So, for example, Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha uses the simile of a wood turner, turning the wood long and turning the wood short, and being conscious of whether he's turning long or short when he's doing it. And that's like when a person is breathing in long, he knows he's breathing in long. When he's breathing out long, he knows he's breathing out long. Breathing in short, knows he's breathing in short. Breathing out short, knows he's breathing out short. Now, you can get a lot of juice about how to do anapanasati properly if you look at the concrete details of wood turning in the time of the Buddha. So wood turning in the time of the Buddha isn't like you turn on a machine. If you want to get a good idea of what the Anapanasati Sutta is all about, a good interpretive frame, something to tie you down in your interpretations, look up a YouTube video, just Google bow lathe. And then you'll get this video, it's got like millions of hits, of this man in Turkey, probably still working today. And he lathes beautiful chess pieces, and I'm sure many other things. A bow lathe is just a curved piece of wood, like a bow, with a string tied across it. You loop that string around a piece of wood, and then you can turn the bow back and forth, and it makes the piece of wood spin. But you need to use your left foot to hold the piece of wood in place, and then use your right foot to hold the chisel in place. And then use your left hand to move the chisel around, pivoting on your foot. And the whole time you're doing this. It's a very coordinated and graceful activity when you see it happening. Very precise activity. With a very particular outcome at the end. So it's not a person bashing away at a technique. It's a person who's constantly adjusting himself with his whole body and his whole mind in order to achieve a very, very difficult outcome. So when you look carefully at the concrete similes throughout the suttas, it ties down how much you can interpret, and also gives you a direction for interpretation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, elephants don't change over 2,500 years, and archery doesn't change over 2,500 years, not in the basic way that these things work.
Mm. So if that's the case, mm-hmm. in early Buddhism, would you say then that it's coherent? Because my understanding of early Buddhism is it's not. There's still differences even within that.
It's largely coherent. So my method, the most coherent set of texts inside the early Buddhism is the Majjhima Nikaya of the Pali Suttas. So in the old days, Nikayas probably didn't refer to texts. Like, Nikaya means group, but it probably didn't refer to like a group of texts because there were no texts, there were people. And so it was actually a group of people, a group of monks, who worked on the basis of a certain group of texts that they all had commonly memorized, or at least very familiar with, and had leaders, the reciters, who knew them like the back of their own hands. Now, when you look at the content of the Majjhima Nikaya, it's clearly the book with the most flesh and the most interest in just practicing as a monk. It's not, the Digha Nikaya seems to be more interested in arguing with Brahmins, and the Samyutta Nikaya is like a whole lot of stuff, and the Anguttara Nikaya is like a whole lot of stuff as well, and it's all a bit random. But when you look at the style of the Majjhima Nikaya, even in the order of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's made by monks who are really interested in practice and really interested in results. So, you know, I think this group of monks, they were serious monks. And that comes out, the message of the Majjhima Nikaya is pretty coherent. There's a few things here and there which don't quite fit the picture. And what I do with that is, when something doesn't fit the picture, then I'll put it into the Microsoft Office trash can. Because it's not a trash can, it's a file. I can always go back to it later. So I always do the tradition that respects. But I also just do common sense a bit of respect by saying, okay, if something is repeated in a formula that seems to be developed by the Buddha to get across a precise meaning 20 times through the Majjhima Nikaya, or maybe like 100 times or 1,000 times across all of the suttas, and then there's one statement in a weird poem in the back of the Kuttana Nikaya that contradicts all of that, then I don't say that the one statement overrules the rest of the body of evidence. Yeah, that's not a common sense approach. So what you can do is, when you look at the formulaic statements that are well repeated, they're pretty coherent. Yeah, it's the details around that that may be contextual and hard to interpret, but if you stick to the well-repeated formulas, I think you're onto a good thing.
So who would you consider as practitioners in early Buddhism?
Oh, I mean, there are people who do it in different ways. So there are a lot of scholars. So a lot of monastic scholars, and there are also lay scholars.
Mm.
And then, you know, people do tongue practice and stuff like that. And so you could say that they're doing their best to practice early Buddhism. It's just that practitioners don't necessarily know the suttas. So if they do know the suttas and they're trying to do the suttas, then I say, yeah, they're doing early Buddhist thing. But there are a lot of people who do Dutangas based upon the Visuddhimagga, which is a Theravada text which was compiled and written about 1,000 years after the Buddha died. But really, the only way to speak with a great deal of confidence about what early Buddhism is, and in the end, what Buddhism is and is not, is you've got to get a whole group of people who become fully enlightened. And they're all doing things that are very easy to verify, like they're all walking through walls in front of each other. And remembering past lives, and say, you know, writing what they remember from past lives without talking to each other, and then, oh, you know, you remember what I remember.
Mm. Yeah, so, are we there yet?
No, we're not there. Yeah, we're getting started. But so when you've got that sort of concrete evidence that you've got it right, then you can speak with confidence. And the Buddha was the same. Like, there's one sutta that I read recently, I think it was the Chula Sakaludai Sutta, where Sakaludai tries to get him to talk about his omniscience. And the Buddha says, oh, look, you know, it's not true that I know everything all the time, but I know everything that I want to know if I direct my mind to it at that time. But you know, in any case, look, Sakaludai, when I'm in company with people who can remember past lives and I talk to them about that, we can have a decent conversation. But when I'm not, then I just talk about other things.
Yeah. Early Buddhism is a tradition, because in other traditions, because monastics, they can ordain other people.
Mm-hmm.
But in early Buddhism, you can't, if you're not enlightened, you can't really ordain someone else.
Yeah.
Does that mean you will, you can't really spread it to like wider?
Well, no, I mean, the early Sangha had no problem because they were enlightened beings.
Mm-hmm.
So I should try to get some clarity on this issue. Okay, so inside the Anguttara Nikaya, there's the rule that you can't ordain anybody else unless you're fully enlightened. And then the same rule is repeated with exactly the same words inside the Vinayapitaka, the basket of rules for monks. But then several watered-down versions of that rule also appear inside the Vinayapitaka. And that's pretty common inside the Vinayapitaka. And it seems what happened was that the rules that the monks were keeping in the Buddha's time were really strict. And they were into excellence. Yeah, they were into standards. And they weren't interested in watering down standards. I mean, the Buddha kicks people out of sangha. He's really tough when you look at the suttas. But it seems that in order to maintain the institution, the rules were watered down. Now, I think what happened was that in the early sangha, the sangha was able to perpetuate itself because the monks were practicing very, very strictly and rationally. They were interested in results, they were interested in evidence and calling a spade and not pulling back on their principles. And because there were plenty of fully enlightened people around, they could ordain people and train them to become fully enlightened and pass it down. But there came a stage where the monks no longer held onto their old standards because they were wealthy, famous, and powerful. And those things tend to breed corruption and dilution of standards and principles. And then they weren't producing enlightened people anymore. And so in order to maintain the institution, to maintain the shell of the Buddha Sasana, they watered down the standards so they could keep ordaining people. But then you have got a problem that you end up having a dispensation that looks like a dispensation, but it's not doing the real thing. And the Buddha warned about this inside one sutta in the Kassapa Samyutta, where he's talking with Mahakassapa, and Mahakassapa is talking about how the young monks don't want to train hard anymore. In particular, they don't want to do ascetic practices. And the Buddha says, yeah, the dispensation is declining, but it declines gradually. And counterfeit Dhamma, Patirupaka Dhamma, arises in the world. And just as when fake gold arises in the world, people stop believing in real gold. And so too, just as when fake Dhamma arises inside the world, people stop believing in the true stuff. It was already happening, say, in the Second Council. So this monk called Yasa, he turns up in Wesali, and the monks are all using money. And he says, that's not what the Buddha taught. And then he recites a sutta where the Buddha made it really clear that the monks should be using money. And the Buddha says, no, monks, if money were allowed, then sensual pleasures are allowed, and sensual pleasures are not allowed to you, monks. And so there's this controversy, and the Vaisali monks completely denounce Yasa. So it's like everything's been turned on its head. That Yasa the good monk comes in and tries to stand up with the Buddha's teaching, and then he's denounced as being the bad monk. But things hadn't declined so much only 100 years after the Buddha's died that he could still go to another region and gather elders who were fully enlightened, and then they came in and re-established the order, so they say.
So where would you say the modern day early Buddhist tradition will go, like from now in the future, if there's a direction for say as a tradition?
Big question. Basically what we have is a building in an old, beautiful building in very deep need of renovation. You know, the foundations have slipped, there are gaps in the walls. It's quite dangerous. And that's what we have inside the traditions, at least Theravada. Theravada is pretty much based on the suttas. But the commentarial layer of literature take Theravada practice quite far away from the suttas. But it's still close enough where those gaps can be filled up if we're willing to just call a spade and say that there are a lot of places where commentary or literature says different things to what's said inside the suttas. And then if we're at least honest about that, I mean, we don't need to fight about it, we can just be honest about that, and then we have a basis to say, okay, we're just doing something different. If we can own up to that, then we can actually see which practices actually lead to better results. Yeah, because if you call everything the same, that look, we're all Buddhists and we're all pretty much doing the same thing, right? Then you rob everybody the ability to actually review the evidence properly. So that's the first thing that we need to do. We need more honesty about this, and we need to be grown-ups about the way that we talk. To not get all het up about it and just say, look, we're grown-ups. We need to do some experimentation to find the truth. And that's something that traditions across the board, Buddhists, non-Buddhists, they're not very good at, because they're just a little bit too sure that they have the truth. So that's dogmatism, being intimidated by competition in ideas. So I think the first thing that we can do to help everybody, because you know the other traditions might be right, I don't know, I'm not fully enlightened, but you know, at least we have good, mature conversations about this, then we've all got a basis to clean up our own practice. So I think that's the biggest thing that early Buddhism can do at this stage. After that, then we clean up our own practices and hopefully some of us become fully enlightened. And then we can create sanghas of fully enlightened beings who are able to give widespread instructions with confidence.
Obviously, it's extremely hard to estimate, but what would be your guess as to the type of numbers of fully enlightened people, say, in the world and maybe in Australia?
You name a few.
Has anyone walked through walls yet?
I'll be surprised there are people who can walk through walls, but that's not necessarily the sign of fully enlightened. It's a sign of really strong samadhi. I'd say that the numbers of fully enlightened people inside the world range from 0 to less than 50. And I don't know any of them.
Do you see Dr. Charles enlightened?
No, I don't think either of them are. Yeah, but that's, no, I like them both. I think they're teaching me, they brought me a long way. But what they're doing is quite different from the suttas. So just on the basis of the four great standards, yeah, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just something, it's a very technical question, but if it's only like, you know, fully enlightened being that can ordain a monk, that means you are not technically ordained?
I mean, technical question, right, yeah. Yeah, is there anyone who's got proper ordination of your... Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a Vinaya master, so I don't know. But it's not the most important question. So, like, having the robes is not about going through a technically correct procedure. Being inside the robes is about being inside a context which can assist you get fully enlightened as soon as possible. And the Sangha isn't about having a group of people who've all gone through the same technically correct Vinaya procedure. The Sangha is about having a community of people who live in such a way and with such common principles and practices that they can, in the most powerful and efficient way possible, assist each other get fully enlightened as soon as possible. So that's why I'm not like really hung up on, say, the question of bhikkhuni ordination. Like, you know, even if you've got a technically correct bhikkhuni ordination, if you're inside a context and inside a community and you've got ideas and practices that aren't conducive to people getting fully enlightened, then it's not a great thing. And if you don't have technically correct ordination, but you are inside that context, then it is a good thing, right? So it's just that wise people always try to line up procedures and Vinaya rules so that they guide people towards the creation of those sorts of conducive practice communities. But there seems to be a big schism between the way rules are interpreted at the moment and the creation of those communities.
Dhamma and things like that as well.
Is it worth reading? I don't think so. But that's just my personal experience. Like, there's so much juice inside the suttas. And the suttas are just more concrete. People often say that the commentaries need to be used on top of the suttas because the suttas aren't detailed enough. But I think that's the point of the suttas. It's like using Google Maps. I shouldn't have used the example of Google Maps. I was going to say that Google Maps doesn't tell you every tree and every building along the way, but it does do that. So a normal UBD map in the old days, it doesn't tell you every detail about the landscape. It gives you a simplified version of the landscape, and that's why it's really useful as a map, because you don't want all the details. You find out the details when you get there. It gives you the essential information that makes your journey much more efficient. Now, so I think the suttas give quite a lot of concrete details about how to live, both as a layperson and as a monastic. The problem is they're really challenging. Like the Buddha's really straightforward with people. And it's so against the stream, in particular, of modern Western society that we would prefer to spend our time reading a lot of commentaries. And arguing over the table at dinner parties about Abhidhamma.
Well, unfortunately, they also argue over the suttas as well. So yeah. Back to my earlier point about interpretations,
yeah.
It's still something, and even within early Buddhism, yeah. where different scholars are arguing over different interpretations and how it's represented.
Yeah.
And that's where I think that there isn't so much, with respect, yeah. the cohesion in early Buddhism.
Yeah.
And some things that can be quite fundamental to the practice yeah. is still disputed about.
Absolutely. So that's why there needs to be experimentation to see what actually works. One of the things that I think is important about the way that Buddha set things up 2,500 years ago is the asceticism and the homeless life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a form of quality control, that if you're not practicing properly, if your understanding is incorrect, or your skillfulness is lackluster, then you won't last. So it's like, if you want to talk about cooking, then you want to be talking to really good cooks, and there needs to be some sort of concrete measure by which you can know whether somebody's a really good cook,
mm.
like a test.
Mm.
So if they really know how to make a great souffle, then you can have a conversation with them. You can join the club.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a concrete measure there. So I think the quality control inside the early Sangha was the homeless life. That only if you had very well purified body and mind would you be able to survive mm-hmm. in that sort of environment. Yeah.
And if we take that standard and that test, yeah. unfortunately, as much as I can perceive, in yeah. early Buddhism there aren't anyone who is fully enlightened
yeah.
who can actually step up and say, well, this is the truth.
That's right. So I think there needs to be people who are willing to experiment and then discuss their results.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully through that collaboration, somebody will get fully enlightened sooner rather than later. And then they can come back and then say, right, work it out, guys and gals. And you'll be able to make progress much faster if you do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get fully enlightened. And then yeah, it works.
But at the moment, there isn't that authority,
no.
so to speak.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't get caught up in intellectual arguments and scholarly debates. I've got a very plain, straightforward approach to the suttas. Basically, I'll look at a sutta and I'll say, okay, what's the Buddha trying to tell me to do? And what's the core ideas behind that practice? And then I'll do it and I'll see what happens.
Mm.
Yeah.
And would you like to share what some of those really core principles are that you've lived and you felt that this has been useful?
Yeah, so
is particularly different to other traditions?
Yeah, so one of the things that characterised the monk's life 2,500 years ago is eating one meal per day.
Mm.
So it's not a hardcore practice. It seems to be like a standard practice inside the suttas, to such an extent that when you get abbreviated versions summarizing what the monk's life is, say in Angulimala Sutta, where the Buddha talks to King Pasenadi and says, okay, if you had a really good monk, how would you treat him? And then he describes like the basic characteristics of a good monk being, he's got good virtue, good character, eats one meal per day. So it's considered to be like a hardcore ascetic practice these days across the different traditions. Now, I just looked at suttas like the Angulimala Sutta or suttas like the Baddali Sutta, where the Buddha scolds Baddali for not eating one meal per day and very, very severely. And the Kitagiri Sutta as well, where the Buddha does talks in praise of eating one meal per day. And I thought, okay, well, clearly the Buddha wants me as a monk to eat one meal per day. I'm not really sure why. But it meant something to him. He goes so far in a number of different places inside the suttas, he repeats himself, saying, monks, I eat one meal per day. You too should eat one meal per day. By eating one meal per day, I have lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. You too should eat one meal per day, because by eating one meal per day, you'll get lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding. So I'm not sure how much clearer a person could be about the matter. So a lot of people have told me that they've tried to eat one meal per day and they got sick as a result. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I mean, if the Buddha's so insistent that eating one meal per day is going to be leading to lightness, strength, and a comfortable abiding, there must be something else going on here. And maybe we're practicing the wrong way. Maybe we're not eating one meal per day in the right way. Can we work out a way to eat one meal per day together with in the context of the whole monk's life, that actually makes a person get lightness, strength, and comfortable abiding? So that's the challenge that I set myself. And I mean, you know, I'm not the healthiest person in the world, but I'm much healthier than I used to be. I definitely had, as a general trend, increasing levels of lightness, strength, and comfortable abiding. And by looking at how eating one meal per day affects my body and my mind, I've been able to work out correct and incorrect ways to interpret instructions inside the suttas. Because if an interpretation leads to me getting a bellyache from eating one meal per day, then it gives me a very clear indication I'm going the wrong direction.
So how do you eat one meal per day to be healthy?
Okay, so I'm just thinking of the howls of resistance once this goes onto YouTube. But here we go.
So, okay, we can take out the comments section.
All right, so gastritis, basically having an upset stomach, is a chronic illness across the Sangha. And as a result, many monks eat more than one meal per day, and even in the evening, because their doctors have told them that they must eat more than one meal per day because they've got gastritis. Now, when I started the holy life, my digestive system was a complete mess. My brother can confirm that for you. But I did it anyway. And what I was finding is, in line with scientific research today, is that your state of mind is very closely linked to your digestive system. And the level of harmony and resilience that you have in your mind comes out inside your gut. So basically, if there's the flame and the inflammation of greed, hatred, and delusion inside your mind, then it's going to lead to inflammation inside your gut. So by eating one meal per day, you've got a very, very concrete indicator about how you're going.
Are there similar manners that a lay person can use to... Let's start with, what are the different advices in early Buddhism versus other traditions for lay people?
Ah, right. Well, early Buddhism is very strong on nekamma, on renunciation. So, now if you go back down to the basics of the Noble Eightfold Way with their formulas, we have the second factor of right motivation, sankappa. And then the first factor out of the three factors of right motivation is nekamma, renunciation. And nekamma is na kamma, so not sensual pleasures. There's this age-old tradition running to today of saying that actually sensual pleasures aren't a problem. It's attachment to sensual pleasures which are a problem. But the early Buddhist approach has to be different because there's the Margandhya Sutta, where the Buddha gives the simile of the leper, where there's a leper with blisters all over his limbs and full of pain and itch. And the only relief that he can get is by flaming himself over a burning charcoal pit. And when he's flaming himself, he gets some relief. Of course, after he's flamed himself, he walks away and his lesions are even deeper, more foul-smelling and infected than before. And so the Buddha says that your craving for sensual pleasures is like leprosy. You've got this itch all over you. And then indulging in sensual pleasures is like flaming yourself over a burning charcoal pit. And you get some relief from your craving, but then after you come away, and then your craving for sensual pleasures is stronger than it was before. And then he also goes further. He says, okay, so the leper, he experiences flaming himself over the burning charcoal pit as pleasurable. Why is that? And the monks say, well, it's because he's mad. His perception is deranged through his sickness. And so the Buddha says, absolutely. In the same way, sensual pleasures are actually painful. They've been painful in the past, they're painful now, and they're going to be painful in the future. So the idea that it's sensual pleasures in and of themselves aren't a problem, but it's attachment to sensual pleasures just doesn't run. It's like the sensual pleasures in and of themselves are hurting you, not just the attachment. It's just that you can't tell because your mind and your bodies aren't clarified to feel it. So in that situation, the proper attitude towards sensual pleasures is actually, you know, just minimalize it to the greatest extent that you can. Because that's the attitude of a sane human being, right? You don't put yourself through pain. That's the whole point of enlightenment. It's the way to bring pain to an end. So monks are told, okay, you've got to eat, so you've got to be exposed to sensual pleasures. You've got to walk around, you've got to see things, you've got to be exposed to sensual pleasures. But, you know, minimalize it so that you don't put yourself through that pain. And then also there's the fact that they're addictive, so that if you do just go in that direction, then not only will you go through pain, but you're going to be stuck in the pain through addiction. So in terms of the lay life, so obviously there's different levels of practice. The monk's life is much more strict on the level, on the question of renunciation. But what we want is to be clear about our orientation as practitioners. If you go with sensual pleasure, okay, so long as you're not attached, then eventually it turns into the idea, which appears in quite a few of the different traditions, that, well, you can be fully enlightened and still be living in the lay world, indulging in sensual pleasures as a normal lay person, indulging in sexual intercourse, going out to restaurants, going to the opera. And a fully enlightened being is just not attached to these things. So the early Buddhist approach, view on that, I'd say would be that that's a trick of Mara. That's a trick that keeps people ensconced in sensual pleasures, that they're addicted, but they're told that they're not addicted and that it's okay. So there's nothing better for an addiction than to have an addiction that is justified. Or an addiction that is the sign of enlightenment. How does that play out? So in something really, really important, Okay, so we live in a world that's very, very troubled. A lot of conflicts, resource shortages, pollution, stuff like that. The Buddha gives a very simple explanation for where all of that comes from. In the Chula Tanha Santana Tanha Chula Dukkha Kanda Sutta and the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta. So the small and the greater discourse on the great mass of suffering. Buddha says all these problems are arising out of people's addiction to sexual pleasures. So out of addiction to sensual pleasures, people go to work in the first place. And then when they're working, they have to suffer. Then because of sensual pleasures, they work and they don't get what they want and then they suffer. Because of sensual pleasures, they work and then they do get what they want, but then they have to protect it. They go through all sorts of suffering as they try to protect it. And then because of sensual pleasures, they fight with their family and with kings and Brahmins and other people, and so there's a whole lot of suffering. And because of sensual pleasures, there is war on a light scale, and then war on a greater scale. Because of sensual pleasures, there's crime and there's punishment and there's torture. Because of sensual pleasures, people misconduct themselves in body, speech, and mind, and then when they die, they go to hell. So you can think of that as like, you know, because of addiction to heroin, there's a whole lot of wars all around the world. People don't think straight. They act like addicts. They're willing to do all sorts of unprincipled, unvirtuous things when they're addicts to sensual pleasures. They're able to find all sorts of very clever ways to legitimize and rationalize their own lack of good behavior and lack of principles. We can say things like, oh, we can start a war and it'll end up good in the end. When our minds are gone crazy through sensual pleasures. Say things like, oh, we can print money and centralize the banking system and that's all going to turn out good in the end. Through craziness of the sensual pleasures. So the purpose of the monks is not to make everybody into monks, but the purpose of the monks is to say, look, if you reject sensual pleasures in the right way, you're going to be happier. Everybody's going to be happier. You'll have your families back, you'll get your communities back, you'll have functional businesses, you'll have functional marriages, children be raised up properly. You'll have good congregations. You'll have peace between nations. But because sensual pleasures are so addictive, if there's no avatars of what happens when you go in the opposite direction in the right way, then people will continue to walk in the opposite way of enlightenment and of a peaceful world. Yeah.
I just came back to the Tibetan Medical Conference where the teacher was speaking about, he sees that guilt is a particular problem in Western societies, mm-hmm. that didn't seem to affect ancient China. So in the ancient China texts don't talk about the energetics of guilt very much, but it's very, very significant. You know, the East Asians are more known to be shame-based, and shame and guilt is very, very different energetically, and that he suspects that that's one reason why people don't like speaking about virtue anymore, because the guilt is so severe, and that's possibly it's going to be a stumbling point for people accepting your message as well, mm-hmm. in particular about sensual pleasures, because it's going to be guilt.
Right, yeah.
Any suggestions?
Good question.
Yeah. I guess the difference between shame and guilt energetically is that guilt is based upon the idea that there's something inherently wrong with you. Like you're born into original sin or something like that. And that if you do something wrong, and because you're like dirty, dirty, dirty and evil on the inside. And so, you know, there's this demon on the inside that you're never going to get rid of, and you And then, so you're going to feel terrible about that anytime that you think about it. It's not a basis for good self-esteem. Where shame just comes from the idea that, well, you're not inherently anything. You're not inherently good, nor are you inherently bad. But there is good and bad. And so if you do something bad, you feel ashamed, but then you can clean up your act. You use the negative experience of feeling shame as like a stick behind a donkey. He drives you from behind. And then you also use all the fruits that come from abandoning the bad and developing the good as the fruit, as the carrot out in front of the donkey. And so it goes wrong where shame turns into guilt due to the lust for power. Where you rise up as a leader, a religious leader or a political leader or a teacher, and you point at everybody below you and say, you're terrible people, and you're all going to hell, and you're all dirty on the inside, and so you destroy a sense of self-esteem. And that's great, because then, people who don't have a sense of self-esteem act more like sheep than like human beings. But the problem is that because people have this experience of guilt, all these really horrible totalitarian structures, they throw shame out the window. So the Buddha's taught actually that hiri or tappa, moral fear and shame, they are the protectors of the world. And you end up with a society where everything has to be positive. Where I think the policy in childcare is you're never allowed to say no to children. And if Johnny wants to jump out the window, you're not allowed to say, Johnny, no, don't jump out the window. You've got to say something like, Johnny, wouldn't you prefer to play with this Lego set instead? That's the policy. I doubt it actually gets implemented because it's impossible to implement. And it's silly. But that's what's happened to our discourse. That we become allergic to negativity.
Yeah. The teacher relates shame to be very much, if you don't have a authority structure, and let's say plainly hierarchy, that is functional, so you kind of know your place at that particular time, then shame doesn't make any sense because it's usually going to be from someone higher than you, or you're worried about how you look to your lower, yeah. or you look to your brother, or you look to your family. Yeah. If you don't care about how you look to your family, then shame's just useless.
So that comes out of becoming allergic to hierarchy. Yeah. So we have the experience of totalitarian systems where we've been exploited and we've been hurt. And being exploited and hurt by people above us inside the system. And so we've decided, generally speaking, in Western society, that all hierarchies therefore must be bad. And they're part of, to use the academic terms, part of the patriarchy, the oppressive patriarchy. And I think that's just going too far. That there's just healthy and unhealthy things. So there are healthy hierarchies and there are unhealthy hierarchies. So a totalitarian patriarchy is unhealthy. But then a hierarchy based upon acknowledging that there's a difference between high level of moral development and low level of moral development is a very, very healthy thing. It's meritocracy in its true sense. And if you feel ashamed that you haven't lived up to, say, your family, which has a reputation of being upright and principled for the last 7 generations, then that will help you become a better person, and therefore is a very good thing. Yes, and it gets connected to how... Okay, this is one big difference between early Buddhism and later forms of Buddhism. Early Buddhism is about development, about step-by-step development, putting conditions together with your willpower to build something up. It's like building a tower or a stairway to heaven. It's an engineering project where the building blocks are inside your own body and mind. Whereas later forms of Buddhism talk and are based upon the idea that there's a shortcut to enlightenment, that there's a Buddha nature of some sort already just out there, and you're already enlightened, because the Buddha nature is everything. You're part of the Buddha nature, and therefore you're already enlightened. There's nothing to develop, and it's your striving which is getting in the way of your full enlightenment. And so all you need to do is actually learn to stop striving and be natural, and then the natural Buddha nature will just emerge. So discourses based upon some kind of view of Buddha nature will tend to go eventually full-bore non-hierarchical. Because people say, well, I'm enlightened, you're enlightened, that we're the same. Usually it takes a bit of time to get there, but that's always the direction that it goes. And then it leads to the destruction of boundaries. It's like, well, killing is full enlightenment, not killing is full enlightenment. Stealing is full enlightenment, not stealing full enlightenment. And you ordinary people who are stuck in ordinary thinking, you just don't get it.
Sorry, Bhante, can you clarify which type of Buddhism would be speaking in that way?
Okay, so there's the Zen adage, for example,
yeah.
That a Zen master can kill a cat.
I wonder whether that's taken too literally. I think it's probably a koan or something.
Yeah, it was taken pretty literally during World War II.
I don't know whether that really is Zen Buddhism, though.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's necessarily what people are doing, but I'm talking about the direction of the discourse.
Okay.
Yeah. It's where it leads eventually through the destruction of boundaries, the destruction of concrete, common sense boundaries.
Mm.
Now, boundaries are made up from the idea that there is the high and there is the low, that there is the good and the bad, the better and the worse. And that can only exist in a discourse based upon building things up. Because if everything is the Buddha nature, then if you have integrity about your ideas,
mm-hmm.
then that hierarchy that people make up in their everyday world is all a sham. Okay, so what early Buddhism is different. What it says is that there is no Buddha nature. Everything is impermanent. But what you do is you cobble together impermanent things in order to build up the stairway to Nirvana. And as you build up the stairway, you develop to higher and higher levels. So there are people who are actually below you mm-hmm. as you develop.
Mm-hmm.
And there can also be people who are above you. Right? So a hierarchy emerges very, very clearly from the practice. And therefore, inside that sort of structure, people aren't afraid to say things like, you're practicing badly, you should be ashamed of yourself. Or you're not studying properly, you should be ashamed of yourself. Or you're not keeping your precepts with integrity, you should be ashamed of yourself. You have made yourself low. And out of love for you, I'm going to make that clear to you so that you can bring yourself to higher levels.
Mm. I think opponents
who... There's no guilt in that.
Sorry?
There's no guilt in that at all.
Yeah.
And those proponents who talk about Buddha nature, they still have, obviously, the sense of virtue and integrity.
Yeah.
And what they talk about is really going back to Buddha nature, because there's a lot of delusions. And a lot of those koans really are to talk about moving away from concepts, particularly the concept of this self,
yeah.
this ego.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I can see what they're trying to do, but I think... there's a certain danger, which I've seen a lot in people's practice, including mine. Okay, early Buddhism's got like a really simple three-step scheme. that as an ordinary person, you'll be attached to the unwholesome. And then what you need to do through practice of the Dhamma is first reduce attachment to the unwholesome by developing attachment to the wholesome. So as the attachment to the wholesome goes up, the attachment to the unwholesome goes down. And then, through attachment to the wholesome, you can develop non-attachment. And if you try to skip from attachment to the unwholesome straight to non-attachment, it won't work. So one thing that defines the unwholesome is that the unwholesome is anything that, if you're attached to, you cannot develop non-attachment. And the definition, one of the definitions I say of the wholesome, of the healthy, is that if you're attached to it, you can use that attachment to develop non-attachment. And so if a person starts to think that they can go straight through, say, through a koan, through non-rationality, from attachment to unwholesome things, to non-attachment, very likely what they're going to develop for themselves is a form of Miccha Samadhi, an altered state of consciousness, which is weird and maybe even nice, but is not leading them in the right direction.
Oh yeah, of course there's always the practice of virtue and morality that comes with it.
Yeah.
It's not just the koan that they rely on.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's really interesting to move from the attachment to the unwholesome,
yeah,
to attachment to the wholesome. Which sutta should we reference that to?
Whoa, that's the... Samana Mandika Putta Sutta. Samana Mandika Sutta, or the Samana Mandika Putta Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 70, maybe 76.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I think what I was trying to get to in the original question was basically, as a lay person, how can I assess? I mean, assessing monks is one thing, but assessing my own practice, I guess, because that's one way of determining for myself what tradition or, you know, absence of tradition, say, that I should be doing.
Yeah.
You know, what are the fruits I should be looking for?
Yeah.
Like, as a concrete thing, I
guess. Yeah, yeah. Just really high levels of integrity in virtue. So you just go through the Noble Eightfold Way. So right speech is not lying, not speaking harshly, not speaking divisively, not speaking idle chatter. So that it's just really concrete things that you can see whether or not you're getting better at or worse at. Right action, not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct. Easy to check. Right livelihoods, not trading in living beings, not trading in meat, not trading in alcohol and intoxicants, not trading in poisons.
So these are not just injunctions, they're measurement tools in a sense as well.
Well, yeah, because every injunction can either be done well or badly.
Clearly you have such a high level of non-attachment that the microphone finds it hard to be attached to.
Yeah, so one thing that I think early Buddhism can do is, can help everybody with, is re-own attachment. You see, for ordinary people, it does seem that unless you're attached to something, it's very hard to maintain motivation. You've got to want something, to be motivated and have energy. And if you're unenlightened, wanting is going to come with attachment. And if you can own attachment, then it makes, it bridges the gap between Buddhism and common sense everyday living. If you can re-own attachment, you're allowed to plan your life. You're allowed to have goals. You're allowed to think about the stepping stones you're allowed to, that you need to achieve in order to attain your goals. You're allowed to generate energy out of your attachment to those goals. That's the way that ordinary people do things when they don't get into spiritual teachings and they become successful and happy. So, if we're allowed to be attached to the wholesome, then we're allowed to be ordinary people. So instead of wanting, or instead of going from wanting cheesecake to just not wanting anything and just being spontaneous all the time, which is a bit weird. I don't think anyone actually does it. And that's like crazy wisdom. You can go from wanting cheesecake to wanting to be fit and healthy so that you can meditate better and so that you can have better relationships with your family. And you don't need to, I'd say, feel guilty about the fact that you have desires, that you're not purely inside the present moment. And so then you can work from that level. Then you end up with, like, through your strategic planning and through your hard work generated through attachment, you end up being a really good family and really good friends, a really good community. Because all these things take a lot of hard work to do, and you've got to be able to hold on to your goals to do it. You know, one big problem that we have inside spiritual communities is that people can become a bit flaky. And it's like, well, I'm not attached now, I'm off. I'm going to do something else. So you get that commitment through your attachment. You build structures, ordinary everyday structures inside the lay world. Good family, good businesses, good schools. And then you live a much more sane life inside of those structures. And it becomes a platform from which, it's a wholesome platform from which you can actually build up real non-attachment gradually over time. And it also becomes a platform from which you can really think for yourself. That you don't need to have the non-attachment of a fully enlightened being or a partially enlightened being who's got it in some way, through some sort of experience, some kind of weird experience that apparently ordinary people don't have. To, you know, to be able to think without delusion and therefore just plan and work out what is good and what is bad, what should we be doing with our lives. But instead you can just go to like really concrete things, like develop a good family and it's okay to be attached to that. Develop a good business and it's okay to be attached to that. And, you know, they'll only be good though if you build them while attached to the concrete rules set by the Buddha. Like, you can do whatever you want with these things, so long as you're within the boundaries set down by the Buddha. A little bit like a soccer game. You can do whatever you want so long as you stay inside the field and you keep to the rules.
And Bhante, when you talk about attachment, is that the translation of upadana or tanha?
That would be upadana, yeah. But, you know, tanha is pretty much the same thing, and they merge together. And yeah, it's okay to crave, like craving for the Dhamma, for example. So this is made pretty explicit in the Ananda Sutta, where the Buddhist, or Ananda, teaches a nun and says that, like, there's a certain kind of conceit which is really good. That's a conceit that says, a person says, look, all these other people are getting fully enlightened, therefore I can do it as well, and therefore I will strive. And like, there's a certain kind of craving that's really good, like craving for enlightenment is really good. I think the big danger that we can fall into when we try to go to non-attachment and non-craving straight away is that basically we just go to delusion, we go into denial. And we do that with ourselves, and we can also do that with others. That out of our this desperate hope that somebody else is fully enlightened or partially enlightened, that we will have this tendency to project enlightenment onto them, because you know that's our only hope. But I think if you go the early Buddhist way, and you say, well, there's still hope if they're attached. And I can call a spade about them. You know, I don't mind that they're angry. I don't mind that they're fearful. I don't mind that they're lustful. But they're pretty attached to the Dhamma, and they're really trying their best. And I can have a conversation with them, see how they're doing, see what the results of their practice is, and together we can work. And it doesn't matter that I'm attached as well. Yeah, if we're both attached to the wholesome, then we've got a basis to go somewhere.
Coming through many traditions in your past, would you say you yourself had a lot of denial?
Yeah. I mean, what I found was
how
that...
How did you detect it as well?
How did I detect it? Well... Okay. So I had a lot of denial in the sense that I can see now that there were hard questions that I did not want to ask. Because I knew subconsciously if I asked those questions I would not get a good answer. And that would destroy my my safety, my sense of safety. And how did I come out of it? Came out of it basically by getting hurt enough. And being willing to just see how the lack of integrity inside of religious communities leads to that suffering. And also noticing, I mean, that would have just killed me. I probably would have committed suicide, actually, if that was it alone. But also noticing that the suttas in their formulas, in the well-repeated backbone of the suttas, particularly found inside the Majjhima Nikaya, it provides a completely different way. So there was a stage in my life where I was just stuck. I was like, right, you know, what's happening in real life inside the communities where I practice clearly is not working. There's just enough evidence across the board in many different practitioners that what's happening is not working. And it's also clear to me that what's happening inside normal life for ordinary people is not working. So if I was just stuck with that, then I would have just killed myself. But what saved me was that when I was practicing in monasteries inside Australia was that I got to know the suttas. And I thought to myself, okay, so practice and life inside the suttas is quite different to what's happening right now. So what would happen if we were to practice in line with the suttas? And that opened a doorway. And I'm still walking down a path that was opened by that door, where it leads, hopefully, to where the suttas say it should lead, to full enlightenment in a gradual way, in a way that can be described in very concrete, straightforward fashion to others.
First of all, one of the things you said is very central is the homeless life of monks. There are many sadhus in India who presumably are far from enlightenment, and also many ascetics. Where are they going wrong?
I think the homeless life does two things in terms of quality control. So one, either you just get really sick and you just have to stop, and so you're done. The second is that you're smelly and you're crazy. And so even if you stay in the sadhu life, nobody else trusts you because you're clearly crazy and you stink. So where are they going wrong? Well, you know, a lot of them take drugs and a lot of them are crazy. They don't think straight. Yeah, they don't think in terms of cause and effect. They're just doing crazy stuff and it's making them crazy.
So another question is, you talked about how many of the monks and the teachers, the fame and wealth and other things, we get to them. What do you think would have happened had everyone stuck to the original teachings that you can't initiate anyone unless you're fully enlightened?
Yeah.
Might Buddhism have then come to a full stop? Would it have been rebirthed at some point in a more pure way? What do you think might have happened?
Right. Well, I think if people kept up with the practices, then the Sangha would have plenty of fully enlightened people to ordain others and to teach them how to become fully enlightened. So we still have like large numbers of fully enlightened people today to teach us. But you know, my hypothesis is that it's possible to get fully enlightened without a fully enlightened teacher, or even a partially enlightened teacher. Because the Buddha seemed to have worked it out for himself without any help. Well, you know, he got clues from other people, but he worked out the final formula for himself. And therefore, if we've got the cheat sheet from the Buddha, it should be much easier than that.
Because I guess what I'm looking at, clearly had everyone stuck to it from the beginning, that would be terrific. But if we take that situation where, okay, people have gone astray, but then if you don't initiate anyone, that presumably has certain negatives, might it have been the best decision at that point to at least keep it going so that people did have the chance to then be in monasteries, to live the life of a monk and to learn?
Oh, look, you know, I'm really, really grateful to the traditions. I mean, I wouldn't be the relatively sane man that I am today, and or would be dead probably if it weren't for the traditions. So I always come to the assumption that everyone's always trying their best. Actually, that's not an assumption. You know, everybody wants to be happy and well, right? And therefore, everybody's actions of body, speech, and mind, whether they're enlightened or not, is driven by the desire to be happy and well. Right? So in that sense, everybody's always doing their best to live good lives. And so people did their best to try to keep the sasana together as much as they could. Now, you know, the what ifs. You know, maybe if people really held on to their integrity in the past, then like Sangha numbers would go down and the people would say, oh, okay, so you know, Sangha numbers have gone down because people aren't willing to live up to the old standards, right? And we're in a lot of trouble. It's like when a patient is sick, you don't hide the symptoms. Yeah, so when you can see the symptoms, you're really motivated to fix up the problem. And it's like, okay, maybe people would say that, oh, Sangha numbers really go now. Our society has really gone down the wrong road. Our society has gotten obsessed with material things and sensual pleasures. Our society is starting to justify warfare. Our society is justifying fraud. And because our society is ensconced in this culture, we're not producing the sorts of individuals who actually want to become true Sangha. And these true Sangha, they're keeping their principles. They're maintaining purity even though we've all fallen down. And we can't get into the club unless we pull up our socks. And then out of that shame, they turn themselves around and the world becomes a much better place. So maybe it could have happened that way. So that's an instantiation of just the general principle of hold on to your principles. If you've done the investigation and you believe that they are good, don't let go of your principles simply because it's too hard for everybody else and simply because other people criticize you. If you're on a boat that's going off the edge of a cliff and you know it, then you're better off jumping out of that boat on the basis of your knowledge and swimming to safety than just sitting inside the boat because everybody else is inside the boat. And everybody else says, you're mad. This stream is safe. And you're doing everybody else a favor by jumping out of that boat. Even if the boat has been there for the last 1,000 years. And I think that as a general principle, it makes sense for everybody in everything that they do, whether they're a monk or a nun, lay man or lay woman. You know, be willing to call a spade and think clearly and point out contradictions, talk about inconvenient truths, in a soft and reasonable way. And there's no way to talk about these things that leaves everybody feeling comfortable. Because, you know, if it was easy to talk about these things, people would be talking about it. Right? If it was comfortable, people would be doing it. But that's the great challenge of a mature human being, to be able to go into controversy and control ourselves out of, at least in my case, attachment to self-control, attachment to being a civilized human being. Rather than just letting civilization disappear, you know, through the gradual sliding of standards.
Last questions?
Question?
Go once. Going twice. Okay. Any last messages?
No.
Thank you, Vanta.
Alright. So, may this Dhamma talk help you all be happy and well, and may it help other people be happy and well, and let's all get fully enlightened as soon as bloody possible.
Thank you, Bhante.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, so much for your participation, your openness in this course. As Bhante says, some of the things that we may be confronted with during this course are these different views and how they sit within us. And I hope that all of you will join us on the 8th of August when we do the panel discussion, an open forum where each of you are able to share your experience from this course as well as from your own practice. And we will have some other people from different traditions to be here to answer any questions and have that open dialogue between the different traditions and different practices. So next week, next Tuesday, we have Sunim coming to give a talk on Zen Buddhism. After we heard what Bhante had to say today. We've got plenty of questions to ask her.
Just to make it clear, look, you know, I criticise everyone. So I do my best not to talk about any particular tradition unless it comes up. But just to, you know, keep to the principles. And what we find is that we're all falling foul of the principles inside the suttas. So, you know, I don't mean to hurt anyone's feelings, but I just know that that's an unfortunate consequence.
You need to invite them both, and then we can see how much anger and hatred.
I did. Well, I don't know about anger and hatred, but I did. Anyway, but Bhante will be starting his katina at that. His retreat at that time. Yes. So, and the katina will be in November. So after the rains retreat, traditionally. We do have a celebration, so we have the Katina celebration, which will be in the Blue Mountains.
In the Blue Mountains, November 12th, it's a Sunday, starts as a pilgrimage from Wentworth Falls train station, and we walk 10 minutes to a primary school near that, and we have our full day Dhamma celebration there. If you want the details, please go to the blog, which is buntejason.wordpress.com. And the details on the events tab.
Hmm. Thank you. And we've also publicized this on our emails as well. So if you're receiving our emails, then you could check on that for the details that would have been sent out earlier today. And for those who aren't on our mailing list, please let me know if you want to join, and I'm happy to pop you onto that. So thank you, everyone, and I wish you all a lovely evening. I look forward to seeing you on Thursday for Qigong or Friday for yoga. And thank you again, Bhante.
Sorry.